got a lot tied up inside.
Got Jesus on. All right. So
all right,
this
take
is
us in.
This is Diane from Willow, Alaska. Welcome to another episode of This Conversation Rocks,
featuring Todd in Los Angeles.
Co-hosted by Todd in Los Angeles.
Special guest appearance by Todd.
No, that would be special guest appearance by Not So Silent Bob. Although not
someday.
Tonight.
Maybe someday. All right. So, well, it's been 2 weeks, and of course, I still haven't gotten the last podcast up. So,
well, and
I'm going to try to do that.
You're insanely busy. We understand this.
This is good. It is good. But oh my God, you'd have to be an IT guy to truly appreciate this special brand of insanity that I'm dealing with right at the moment.
Well, and
I get good clients, and I love them, and so it's all good.
Except the ones who forget their bills. That would be me. I protested that I did not receive it. In fact, I did.
Fortunately, I'm not living on what you're paying me.
No kidding.
Oh.
So this is the all brain episode, right?
Right, and no zombies, just brains.
There you go. Now we'll leave that to the guys at Biters, right?
That's right.
And we're going to introduce our new episode or new segment, which is called
"Fuck That Guy."
Right
not
on.
That we're not that we're stealing this from anybody or anything, John Oliver. But yeah, fuck that guy.
I watched an episode of John Oliver. I wasn't that impressed, I gotta be honest. I know he's listening, so, you know.
Okay, what? Not impressed?
I don't know. I just always liked Colbert and Stewart better.
Oh, well. What I love about Oliver's show is that he spends 20 minutes on a topic. That's a pretty good amount of time on a topic.
Yeah, that's pretty rare these days.
Right, unless you're listening to This Conversation. All right, well, so since this is the All Brains episode, where do you want to start? Which brain malfunction should we start with tonight?
Let's start with one that we're relatively neutral about for ourselves, and then we can work into those that we are less neutral about.
Okay, so...
So we're going to start with migraines, and this is for someone who listens.
Yeah, it really is.
So,
good for us.
Yeah. So, actually, you know, this was really interesting. I kind of approached all three of the topics we're going to talk about tonight from the point of looking at how common they are, how they impact us socially, because I think it's really important for people to understand that what we're talking about is not just something that afflicts one person in a vacuum.
Absolutely.
So,
absolutely.
I thought this was really interesting. This is from the migraineresearchfoundation.org, and one out of four households in the United States include someone with a migraine. So super common. So in every four households, they figure it's 12% of the population, and it's the eighth most disabling illness in the world.
Yeah, well, that I totally believe.
So I just thought that was really interesting. There's other facts and figures that I thought were fun that I thought I'd share. It's much more common in women, 21% as opposed to 10%.
That's interesting. I'd kind of noticed that, but I didn't really understand that there was actual stats behind that.
So I'll tell you, I think in my experience as a nurse practitioner that it's probably different because of hormonally mediated migraines. Like, I definitely know women who have menstrual migraines or who have worse migraines at specific times in their cycles.
Okay.
So I suspect that's probably why it's more common in women than in men.
Yeah, that would make sense.
But I'm not a neurologist, so there you go.
But you could be.
I might be.
You might be. That's right.
Nah.
All right.
No ologist passed behind my name.
Never say never.
Oh, God. All right. So the other thing that I thought was interesting is American employers lose $13 billion a year simply due to lost work days from people calling in with migraine.
And that's a big number.
That's a huge number. And they figure that migraine and chronic headache, in terms of medical costs, cost the U.S. about $50 billion a year.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's huge. And I have to say, you know, when I look back, I see a fair amount of migraine and a fair amount of chronic headache.
Okay. So what do we know about migraines? What are potentially some of the causes?
Well, so this is interesting. We don't really know a lot about migraines. We think we know how it happens, but we're not really sure. And in terms,
it has this huge an impact.
Seriously,
and we don't know shit.
Seriously, you know, there are some theories about migraine, but at this point, they're just theories. We don't really have a solid understanding of causation, and there's tons of variations of migraine too. I don't know if I ever told you this story, but my husband showed up at my place of work one day several years ago, and thought he was losing his eyesight. He was actually having all of the visual symptoms of migraine without the headache. And they call it an ocular migraine.
Wow.
Yeah, so he would have these random vision changes that were migraine without the pain. He also had more traditional migraines, but the visual ones really scared him.
I would imagine so, yeah.
Yeah.
So does he suffer from migraines on a regular basis?
He has not had them in a long time, but Imitrex was really a lifesaver for him. That's one of the medicines that I'll talk about tonight that's used to avert migraine.
Okay. All right, so we don't know shit about what causes.
So we do know that for some people there are specific triggers. Mm-hmm. You know, like some people can be triggered by being exposed to certain foods or certain allergens. There are people who say that weather changes are a trigger.
Wow, that would suck.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that we talk about, and this is actually one of the pieces of advice that I was going to give, was to keep a headache diary. And basically, in a headache diary, you're describing when it happened, what you ate, what you were doing, what the symptoms were. I mean, it's pretty explicit, and it's a way to try to help your primary care provider, or if you get a referral to neurology or a headache specialist, it's a way to help them identify what kind of headaches you're having and what you can do to hopefully prevent them.
All right.
And I wanted to share a website with our listeners. So there is a website called www.headache.org. Sorry, headaches.org. It's the National Headache Foundation. And they actually have a downloadable headache diary that's pretty complete that people can use to start tracking headaches so they can take it into a visit with them.
Excellent. Excellent.
And, you know, I'll be honest, the headache is one of those things, migraine is one of those things where you really hope that it's not the big bad, but sometimes you have to send people for special testing to rule out big bad things like a bleed or a tumor or things like that.
Wow, okay. Any idea how common that actually is with migraines?
You know, it's actually pretty uncommon. I can honestly say in, goodness, almost 20 years of being a nurse, I had one patient come in with the, quote, worst headache of her life, and she, in fact, was having a massive stroke in front of my eyes. And there was nothing that any of us could have done.
Holy shit.
But by and large, that's pretty rare.
Okay.
I don't have numbers specific to the issue, but it's not typically what you see.
Okay, good.
That said, if somebody comes in with new headaches, the worst headache of my life, headaches that were kind of normal and suddenly had changed character or have gotten a lot intense or a lot more frequent, I'm probably going to order some imaging for that patient.
Right.
Just to rule out those big, bad, scary things.
Okay, so what can you do to alleviate?
Well, so this is kind of interesting. There's a couple of things that I wanted to say about alleviation. One of them is that the most common form of headache in the United States is rebound headache, which actually is because we're overusing over-the-counter medications, or in some cases, overusing prescription medications. So if you're having to take a medication for headache more than twice a week, odds are you're probably experiencing a rebound headache. So back to rebound headaches. They actually can happen with overuse of prescription or over-the-counter medicines. So people need to be really careful with Aleve, Tylenol, ibuprofen, because they could potentially be making their chronic headache worse by overusing those meds. And what I read about rebound headaches is that they usually go away when you stop the medication, but they are really a nightmare to treat because of that chronic recurrent nature.
Right.
So, and, you know, sometimes, in all honesty, being healthcare providers, we try to help people and we try to prevent things, and I think we actually make them worse. I mean, I'm thinking about a patient that I have right now who probably has rebound headaches because of her prescription medication. And that I'm contributing to.
All right, I got nothing on that.
Well, do no harm, right? So that's something that I need to reevaluate. Anyway, so there are medications that can alleviate migraine or avert migraine, but you have to take them early in the course of the migraine. And those are the medications called the triptans, which are things like Imitrex, Relpax, Frova. There's a bunch of different triptans, but they're all pretty much related. They have different duration of effect, and they have different onset, but they're all essentially the same chemical base.
So what do they do?
You know, my understanding, and I'm probably going to show my ignorance here, is that they actually help vasodilate, or maybe they vasoconstrict. I honestly can't remember. I think they have to do with vasoconstriction, quite honestly. But what they do is they change the blood flow to the area of migraine.
Okay.
And boy, now I sound really ignorant. But the bottom line is if you take one early and you have found one that's successful for you, they're pretty good at averting the migraine.
Excellent.
There are also meds that can be used for migraine prophylaxis or prevention. So for people who don't get a great response to the triptans, or people who have a lot of migraines in spite of having a triptan that's effective, we can actually try putting them on a daily medicine to help prevent migraines in the first place.
And how does that one work?
Again, not really sure. It's kind of one of those, hey, we have this medicine and we found out the great side effect is that you're not getting migraines anymore, so we think we'll try it.
Excellent.
So
we need to get a pharmacist when we do one of these episodes.
No, this is really true. I'm not kidding. This one, we really don't exactly know why these medicines prevent migraine, but they're medicines that we developed for other reasons. So some of the seizure drugs, anti-seizure drugs, some medications that are used for cardiac conditions or blood pressures can be used off-label, which means, hey, we figured out this works, but the FDA hasn't tested it. We can use them off-label to prevent migraine. For example, Topamax, which is a psych med, in the right doses, in the right people, can keep them from getting migraines. I've actually had a patient who's had tremendous success with that, with Topamax. So,
excellent.
Yeah, so, you know, the preventive meds are trial and error. And quite honestly, the triptans can be trial and error, too. You might not respond well to one, and you might respond fantastically to another. But, you know, the bottom line is to start keeping track of headaches and then make sure that you get in with someone who either knows how to treat headache or can refer you to someone who treats chronic headache or migraine.
Okay.
And I wanted to say a couple other things about other modalities, because as a culture, and I think as someone who practices Western medicine, we're so focused on meds that we forget about other things. But things like seeing a chiropractor, going to physical therapy, massage, stress reduction, they can help reduce or prevent migraine. And
okay,
interestingly enough, there is a school of medicine that's injecting Botox into specific nerve groups, and that seems to be shutting down migraine.
Well, that's a much better use for it than your forehead.
Yeah, there you go. And, you know, there are also things like nerve blocks where they will inject numbing medication into a nerve group to prevent migraine. Or for people who have really severe headaches, pain specialists can actually put in a nerve stimulator, which is a little machine that generates signal and disrupts the signal that's creating the pain. So there's some pretty interesting, complicated stuff that can happen around headaches and chronic pain.
But the point being is that there's always some more options available.
Yeah, you know what? People shouldn't give up. And again, people should really be looking at their medication use habits. So if it looks like you're using a lot of medications, it's worth readdressing things with the person who's prescribing. Or if you're using a lot of over-the-counter meds, it's worth talking to someone about what your pattern of use is and if there's something that would work better for you.
Good.
So, you know, migraine is definitely bad, and it definitely costs our society and individuals a lot of money, but there are things that can be done.
And it's worth pointing out one more time, right, that 12% of the population...
12% of the population. This is not fake, and this is not something that people are BSing.
Right. I mean, it's, you know, pretty common, 1 in 10. And then add to that, what was it, $50 billion in losses every year?
$50 billion in direct medical cost.
Direct medical costs, sorry.
$13 billion in losses in terms of time lost at work or productivity lost at work.
Yep.
Because, you know, that's what it's all about, time at work and productivity at work.
Hey, when... yes, but here's the point.
I know, I'm just being snarky.
when you've got an employer who's being bitchy, you know, having some stats goes a long way.
Oh, I agree. I definitely agree.
Yep. All right, so migraines, they suck.
Yeah, so that's kind of the short, sweet, and sucky version of you have a migraine, here's some suggestions.
Good.
So what do you want to talk about next? Do you want to talk about your concern or my concern? Which ultimately is all of our concerns, right?
Well, I mean, you know, we can talk about Alzheimer's for a few minutes. Yeah, it's no secret. People who know me know that my stepfather has it. And it sucks.
Well,
it really sucks. And he's been luckier than most. He's gotten through several clinical trials that I think have probably prolonged his situation positively. I can't imagine what it's like, you know, for people deal with this, and you know, it just goes from bad to worse in a pretty constant decline. My stepfather's been fortunate. He plateaued for a long time, and he's now in decline, and God, you know, it's awful.
I was gonna say, it sounds like it's gotten more stressful lately.
Absolutely.
You know, not to pry, but
yeah, but it's one of those things. One of the interesting side effects, of course, unintended consequences, probably a better way to put it, is that exercise, you know, no surprise, exercise helps you in all cases, but he is in the best shape of his life.
Right.
You know, his brain is going long before his body is going to quit.
And it's actually pretty often the case that the body outlives the brain.
Yeah.
I've got a good friend. You know this person. I'm not going to say her name on the podcast. Her mom, who was just an incredible person, very vital, pleasure to be around, early onset Alzheimer's, and now, within the space of a couple of years, doesn't recognize anyone, doesn't even recognize my friend.
Yep.
And it's very, very sad. And it's the same thing, you know, her brain is just not there. She's not there, but her body keeps going.
And it's impossible. It's an impossible situation, right? If you're the immediate family.
Oh, absolutely.
They're, yeah. This, yeah, what I deal with is mostly secondhand, right?
Right. So. Does your stepdad still recognize your mom, if you don't mind me asking?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. He knows who all his kids are. He knows who my mom's kids are. I mean, he's known us for 20 some odd years. So, you know, but I was talking to him the other day. He couldn't remember what I do for a living, even in the most general terms, which again, you know, it just he's losing it here and there. And,
right.
He does not recognize my wife most of the time because... You know, she came into the picture
when he was already ill.
Right.
Yeah.
It's just awful. Right, and anybody who's dealing with it knows that.
You know, I heard of... Oh, go ahead.
The thing that's amazing to me, though, is that we just didn't care about it medically for the longest time. You know, now that the baby boomers have retired and it's, you know, there's a lot of... I hate to say it, but it's because there's a lot of money there.
Sure, and there's a lot... It's because there's a high volume of people who are potentially experiencing this.
You know, the research has kicked into high gear.
Yeah.
They have had some success with some... I know this just from the clinical trials that my stepfather's been through.
Mm-hmm.
They definitely have some stuff that at least for a while stops the plaque from growing, which is pretty amazing.
Now, is that stuff that's generally available to the public, or is that stuff that's still in trials?
It's all in trial.
Because I'm thinking about the stuff that I know to give patients, and my bottom line to them is we may slow the progress, but we're not going to stop anything, and we're not going to reverse anything.
Right, and even the stuff that, you know, in the trials, it only prolongs the inevitable.
Right. You want to hear... go ahead.
You know, anything that gives people another couple of years of a decent life, you know, is not a bad thing, though.
As long as it gives them good quality, you know? I mean, as long as it really makes it meaningful for people. You want to know something really shocking that I heard fairly recently on NPR?
Hmm.
Over 50% of patients who are diagnosed with Alzheimer's never hear it from their primary care provider. They never hear the words coming out of their primary care provider's mouth.
Yeah.
Like, people die without hearing the word Alzheimer's.
No, it's true. So, I've heard that story. I shouldn't say it's true. I don't know this. But I've heard that story a lot.
Well, you know, we're scared to say it. We dance around it. And after hearing that report, I swore I was not going to be one of those people.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's human nature, right? You don't want to tell people they got a death sentence.
Right. You don't want to give people bad news. But the other thing is, you know, I think especially early in the onset, if we're honest with people, we give people a chance to plan. We give people a chance to maximize the good time that they've got left.
Absolutely.
You know, it's just like any other chronic health condition. If we really let people know what the deal is, they're going to use their time better, generally speaking.
Yep. I was watching... This isn't anything new, because I was watching a documentary about Babe Ruth, of all people, on HBO the other day, right?
Uh-huh.
Cancer, right? And his doctors never told him what he was suffering from.
Which is just unconscionable. I mean, and that things like that still happen.
Yeah.
Which is just appalling.
Well, Western medicine... The problem in the West is that we believe that we're going to live forever, and if the medicine we have doesn't allow for that, nobody wants to talk about it.
Well, and it's very true, and we look at not being able to cure something as a failure.
Right. And see episode 6 and 7 right?
Well, and sometimes I think that we need to look at not helping people prepare as the failure.
Yeah.
Because death is inevitable.
Right.
Old age, and for some people, infirmity is inevitable. So why don't we help people use their time better? That's how we really have to look at it.
Yep.
So I have some scary statistics about Alzheimer's. So every 67 seconds in the United States, someone develops Alzheimer's dementia.
That is a scary number, but of course, I don't really know what that number means.
Well, but think about it when 50% of those people aren't going to be told anything about their health problem.
No, I understand. But I mean, you know, what does that equate out to, right?
So let's see. I've got a few numbers that might help make it more meaningful. This is from the Centers for Disease Control. So 31% of people who are in adult daycare have Alzheimer's. 39% of people who are in residential care, like in a nursing home, have Alzheimer's. 30% of people who have home health and 44% of people who have hospice care have some form of Alzheimer's dementia. And then overall, looking at the population of nursing home residents, it's something like 48% of nursing home residents. So that's a huge number.
Right, but again...
You don't know how many people are in nursing homes in the United States, so it doesn't make it totally meaningful.
Right, and the other thing, of course, is that absolutely you would expect that the number of people in nursing homes with Alzheimer's would be much higher than the general population.
Right.
That's why they're in nursing homes.
Well, let me put it to you in a way that might be more meaningful. It's the sixth leading cause of death for people in the U.S.
Okay, now that's interesting.
It is the only cause. Go ahead.
You know, it sucks, but you know, silver lining and all that, right? The reason it's the sixth leading cause of death is because we're getting to live long enough for it to kill us.
That is very true. That is very, very true.
And that's one of the reasons why, you know, again, there wasn't a whole lot of research previously and everything, is because if the general population was dying off before Alzheimer's was kicking in, well then, not much point in that. So.
By the way, if you hear all that right. craziness in the background, that is actually rain hitting the roof. We're in the middle of a horrendous rainstorm here. Oh, that's right. People in California have forgotten what that sounds like. I'd gladly send some your way.
Everybody would. I don't quite understand why we can't just do that. I mean, we got pipelines that run oil all over this country. How about some pipelines that run water?
Of course, you do realize we were bitching earlier this summer about not having enough rain and having forest fires, but now we're like, please stop. So.
Yep. Everybody bitches about the weather, yet nobody does anything about it. So a couple things, though, that I've been told about Alzheimer's.
Go for it.
They go in with what you know. That it tends to be hereditary.
There is definitely a genetic link. Yep.
Okay. So I'm feeling a little bit better that nobody in my direct DNA has it.
Yeah, I'm not feeling real excited that 3 out of 4 grandparents on my husband's side died of Alzheimer's complications.
Ooh, that's bad.
Uh-huh. Tell me.
Ouch.
Let's see.
God, this is depressing.
It's depressing. We're doing the all brain episode. It's depressing. We'll get to fuck that guy and people will laugh.
Why is the brain so depressing?
Because, you know, people talk about the heart as being the seat of our soul, but I really think it's the brain that's the seat of our soul.
Oh shit, the heart doesn't do anything. It just pumps blood. I mean, it's stupid. Yeah, the heart. Fuck my heart, right? I can replace that and I'm still the same guy.
You know, when we talk about the brain and when we talk about the brain failing, we're talking about what really makes us us. And that's why exactly it's so depressing.
It. Yeah, because if you watch somebody with Alzheimer's, they are slowly losing everything that makes them them.
Right, exactly. I mean, my friend's mom is still my friend's mom, but she doesn't know that.
No, that's right.
Which is super, super sad.
There'll come a point where he doesn't know who I am. There'll come a point where he doesn't know who his kids are, which is far sadder.
Mm-hmm.
And there'll come a point where he doesn't know who his wife is, and that's really sad.
I think that's one of the saddest things that my friend told me about her mom, is that her mom now calls her husband of many years that guy. She doesn't know who he is, he's just that guy.
And why is he hanging around?
Right.
Yep. Mm.
So, a little more
This is even a Nicholas Sparks fucking movie, isn't it?
This is more like a Stephen King fucking movie.
Yeah.
So to add to your depression, so they figure in the year 2015, they being like the CDC and the organizations that track things, right, that Alzheimer's and related dementias will cost the United States $226 billion.
Yep.
And by the year 2050, they estimate that the annual cost of Alzheimer's and related diseases will be $1.1 trillion a year.
Outstanding. We got to fix this, guys.
Yeah. And again, I mean, you said it based on the trial medications that you've seen your father-in-law on. I say it based on the medications that I can prescribe. We can slow it, but we can't stop it. And we can't make it better once it starts.
Right. Although if there is something to be said about slowing it, right? Because if you can slow it enough, it doesn't matter.
You know, and I'm just wondering if I have not had enough experience yet with people who are truly suffering from severe Alzheimer's. But I don't really see that those medications make a lot of difference.
Again, like I said, what I've seen is clinical trial stuff. Positive results, but they don't last, right? You know, I mean, he's sliding again.
Right.
After all this.
But I mean, you know, that's at least at least you've seen some plateaus, and at least you've seen some long periods of time where the progression hasn't been so obvious. I can't say I've seen that with the medications that are currently available on market.
Right. So, you know, hopefully they can continue to develop this stuff and get it out. The next generation is waiting.
Actually, and you know, you bring up an interesting thing, and I wish I had the book in front of me. There's a book by a fellow named Robert Martinson called A Life Worth Living, and this guy is an ER doc and a medical ethicist. He actually spends a fair portion of the beginning of the book talking about what different stages of clinical trials are and what the companies are actually testing for in those clinical trials. So I think it would really behoove people to take a look at that and really understand what they're getting into if they look at participating in a clinical trial, because some of these, like a stage one trial, they're not even looking at whether or not the medication can help you. They're kind of trying to figure out how much can we give you before you have really bad side effects.
Right. And the other thing that everybody should understand about clinical trials is you may not be getting the medicine.
Right. Exactly. Because if we're doing an honest double-blind study, some people get the medicine, some don't. And even the researchers don't know who's getting the medicine.
Right.
Yeah. So I just, having been someone who's worked in healthcare for a long time, I want to say I read Dr. Martinson's book probably 6 years ago. And I did not have a good understanding of clinical trials until I read his description. And I thought he explained it really, really well. So I would encourage people to pick up his book. I'll put a link on the website if I think about it, or a link on the Facebook page.
Perfect. Or if I ever edit this podcast, I'll try to write it down.
So did you want to say anything else about your experience with Alzheimer's? Because I had just a few pieces of advice for people who are caregivers to someone with Alzheimer's.
All right, go ahead.
So first of all, the Alzheimer's Association, which is a national association, can be a great support for people. They can help with finding respite caregivers, and they can help support groups for people who are caregivers to kind of help them learn from other people's experiences and decompress their experiences. So I'd really encourage anyone who is helping a family member with Alzheimer's or dementia to talk to the Alzheimer's Association. And then these are just some things that I found online that I thought might be useful. So the government, National Institutes of Health, actually has a downloadable caregiver's guide. The website is www.nia.nih.gov, and it looked like it was pretty helpful and it was free. And then just some tips from the Mayo Clinic. Schedule carefully if you are helping someone with dementia. Involve that person in scheduling as much as they're able to, but don't present them with a lot of choices. You know, give them like one or two choices, but don't make it really complicated.
Right.
Because the more complicated it is, of course, the more confused and the more distressed the person's going to be. Provide really simple instructions about how to get something done. Because, again, the more complicated the instructions, the more likely the person is going to be confused or distressed. And then when you're working with that person, reduce background distractions. So don't have background music, don't have TV. Really make that interaction that you're having with the person be the focus of that experience so the person can get the most out of it.
Good. Good advice.
Yeah. So, you know, I think it's probably not as hopeful as migraine, but I think there are definitely things that we can do to help people cope better. And number one is honesty from primary care providers. So I hope that people who are healthcare people who are out there listening pay attention to that.
All right.
Okay. So the last, the so happy last of the brain trio. So, you know, as our listeners, God bless them, know that traumatic brain injury has become near and dear to my heart. So I looked up some information about TBIs, you know, because even though I'm sounding fairly normal, I'm still struggling with some of the aspects of recovering from a TBI. And the CDC actually said that it is a major cause of death and disability in the U.S. 30% of all injury deaths result from a traumatic brain injury. So we're seeing a lot of it. Go ahead.
Any understanding as to why we're seeing more of these?
Well, so, I mean, I definitely think that we're seeing more of it as a result of the conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq. You know, we're really,
absolutely.
We're unfortunately for those soldiers learning a lot more about traumatic brain injury and its impact from them coming back from overseas. I don't wish it on any of them. But we are learning from them.
And the rise in extreme sports?
Yeah. So this is kind of interesting. It actually, let's see, for people over the age of 65, falls are the number one cause of traumatic brain injury.
No, that makes sense.
For people between the ages of 5 and 24, motor vehicle accidents are the number one cause of brain injury.
Okay.
And then people from the age of 0, so the newborn, to the age of 4, assault is the number one cause of TBI.
Okay, that's fucking wrong.
Yeah, but you know, think about it. You've heard of and you've seen all those educational things about shaken baby syndrome.
Yep.
So those are the kinds of things that we're talking about when we're talking about traumatic brain injury in young kids.
Exactly. That's fucking wrong. That number should be zero.
That number should be zero.
All right. And so how about for people, what was it, over 24?
It doesn't, there aren't really stats, or there weren't really stats at the sites that I looked at that really talked about that age group between 24 and 65. So I think hopefully that's when people get a little smarter and a little less vulnerable. And then, of course, when we start seeing falls in people over 65, it's because of the consequences of aging and disease. So
Alzheimer's.
Right. So this was interesting. And, this really bears out what I see in a state where we have extreme sports and where we have a lot of hunting and fishing and those kinds of things. Men are three times as likely to die of a traumatic brain injury as women.
Okay, makes sense.
You know, and it just makes sense because men are generally participating in some of those extreme sports in larger numbers.
Yeah, at a much higher rate.
And they're also acculturated to do risky things, you know, more so than women. I mean, I think that's changing, but still more so than women.
I was watching Real Sports on HBO.
Oh, right? Were you watching the stuff about concussion and football?
No.
Oh, no. Okay, tell me.
I was watching their segment on the flying squirrel suit.
Really? You know,
these guys who strap themselves into the suits that allow them to fly.
Uh-huh.
And the rate at which they're killing themselves, 1 in 20.
Wow, that's pretty significant.
Yeah, yeah, because you're going fast.
Right.
And these guys like to do tricks because they've got no common sense.
And because you're flying.
Because otherwise they wouldn't be flying, right?
If right.
They had any common sense. But in these suits, this is crazy, right? These suits, you basically can fly 3 feet for every foot you drop.
Uh-huh.
Right? I mean, so basically, right, you know, if you jump off something that's about a mile high, you're going to go about 3 miles. You hit speeds of upwards of 100 miles an hour.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, and then you do tricks like trying to fly between rocks and stuff at 100 miles an hour, and, you know.
That sounds like a brain injury waiting to happen.
I think the thing is probably not a whole lot. I think there's probably not a whole lot of traumatic brain injuries.
Because they die.
Right.
Well, but remember, 30% of all injury deaths are because of brain injuries.
Right, okay. Well, yeah, technically.
So technically they're brain injuries.
Technically,
but
you didn't die from smashing into the rocks at 100 miles an hour. Technically, you died from the traumatic brain injury that occurred because you smashed into the rocks at 100 miles an hour.
So just out of curiosity, were there any women featured in this, or was it all men?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Of course there's women.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But by and large, fewer, would you say? I'm leading.
Yeah, well, and the one they featured, both of her previous husbands died doing this, so of course she's totally all in, right?
So you know, part of me says
hooked up with a third guy who does this for fun.
Part of me says I just don't understand, but the voice in the back of my head is saying you can hardly wait to get back on your horse. So,
right. Well, I mean, it all depends on, you know, whether or not you look at it and go, flying squirrel. That looks cool. You know, and I mean, you know, and I guess where I'm going with this, right, is in the extreme sports, traumatic brain injury stuff, is, you know, they're interviewing some of these guys, and they're interviewing some guy who broken both ankles twice.
Oh my God.
You know, his knees, both knees once, right, 12 ribs, 3 vertebrae. And after doing the interview with HBO, Real Sports, he went out, jumped off the cliff, you know, so that they could film him. Crashed and burned, broke both ankles again, his femur.
Oh, man.
You know, and then, of course, they got the interview with him 6 months later when he's back up and running. And, I mean, he's just, this is all he wants to do, right? And you just realize they're wired differently than most of us.
This kind of makes me think of a cowboy that I met when I was working at a pain clinic. He was an older gentleman, probably in his 70s or 80s, and just broken up, you know, and now getting treatment for chronic pain. And I said, right. I said, knowing what you know now, would you still do it? And he said, oh, hell yeah.
Of course he would, yeah. I mean, so, that's what he lived for.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, so one of the points that I wanted to make about traumatic brain is that, and I thought this was interesting, it encompasses impairments that last for a few days to things that last for a lifetime. And I'm really seeing that in my own journey through traumatic brain injury, you know, you've got things that go away and you've got things that you wonder, is this going to be the new normal? Is this going to be how it is from now on? And you don't really know.
And you won't know for quite a while.
Right. I would say for up to a year. I mean, my understanding, and granted, even though I'm living it, it's still fairly limited, is that you've probably made all the progress you're going to make after about a year. That's not true for everyone. There are those miracle cases that continue to improve, but most people level out after a year.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the estimated cost of traumatic brain in 2010, so this was not the newest number, but I think kind of at the height of us really starting to recognize people coming back with traumatic brain from the service, $76.5 billion a year, direct and indirect medical costs. So that's cost of care, missed work, lost productivity, those kinds of things.
Right. Well, and of course, the TBI suffered in the military as a result of the wars. This is speculation, but I'm going to go out on a limb and say probably far worse than what you generally experience in the normal, you know, in the normal world.
Oh, I absolutely think so. I actually met someone fairly recently who had not had a combat experience, had not come across an IED, but said, I spent 3,000 hours in the back of a Black Hawk. What do you think?
Ooh.
And I thought, he's probably a high risk for a traumatic brain.
Got rattled around a lot.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, it's good that the brain has some room to rattle around, but sometimes that's not a good thing. That's how we end up with shearing, and that's how we end up with injury in two places instead of one, because you get injured where the brain hits, the brain sloshes back and hits in the opposite part of the head, so you actually end up with two brain injuries, the direct and the indirect, or coup contra coup is what we call it in healthcare.
And, you know, as the NFL is at least alluding to at this point, you don't just shake that shit off.
Right. You know, and fortunately, I've got to say, having dealt with school-age kids as a school nurse and as a primary care provider, I think we're overall seeing better attention to return to play and concussion awareness. But I still see coaches who say stupid things like, don't be a pussy, shake it off and get back in there.
Right.
I'm like, okay, first of all, you lost me at calling the kid a pussy. And secondly, you lost me with your lack of awareness about brain injuries.
Yeah, well, you know, Neanderthals.
Right. So just some things that we can do to help people, both people who have brain injury and preventing brain injury. It's education. So we need to educate people about prevention, seat belts, child seat restraints. We need to educate people about impaired and distracted driving. So drunk driving, texting. I've got to tell you, I still get distracted by my damn phone. And I'm embarrassed to admit it, but I just need to put it down. And yeah. I would wager that there are a lot of us out there who aren't necessarily copping to that. Teen drivers. So I don't know what the laws are in California, but things have changed a lot in Alaska since I got my driver's license. You actually go through a provisional license and you have to drive with an adult for a while, and you can't drive at night for a while. You can't drive with other teenagers in the car. And I think those are all good things.
Probably, but
I know we never went through that. But
yeah, there's that teenage part of my brain that's going, that's bullshit.
Right. So just out of curiosity, does California have any restrictions like that?
Oh yeah, yeah. They're all everything you just named. And you know, honestly, I think that this is probably the number one reason why teenagers are not nearly as interested in cars as our generation.
Good point. Well, I didn't learn to drive until I was 19, so.
Oh.
But well, I was an outlier.
Yeah, I mean, because when I grew up in Southern California as a teenager, back in the 80s, getting your car was everything.
Yeah, I mean, most of my friends had learner's permits by 14 and driver's licenses by 16.
Yeah, and you know, it was freedom, right?
Right.
You could have a job. It meant that you could go out with your girlfriend. It meant that you could, you know, do all of these things, right?
Right.
And, you know, these days, even if you have a car, if you're a teenager, you can't do any of that. Because you can't take your girlfriend out.
Yeah. You know? Absolutely, because she's a teenager too, at least we hope.
Maybe she's a teacher, but that's a different story.
Oh my God, we have to do an episode about statutory rape law at some point. So other things, talking to people about pedestrian safety. talking to especially elderly or extremely ill people about fall prevention. And
right.
for people who have someone in the family who's sick or who's older, you can actually have a home health agency come out and do a home safety evaluation where they can help you look for ways to prevent falls. So,
okay, good.
I mentioned it, but sports and recreation safety. So being aware of return to play rules and sticking to those.
I think one of the most interesting things you said last time was about the fact that re-injury rate, once you've injured yourself,
sure.
re-injury rate,
you're much higher risk
within a certain amount of time after the initial injury. It's just really high.
And I want to say, and I would have to look again at the return to play rules, but it's something like within the first 2 weeks, you are actually at very high risk of a lethal brain injury if you return, for example, to a contact sport after you've had a concussion. So your risk of having a fatal brain injury is much higher.
Wow.
Yeah. Which, you know, we didn't know, say, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. We do know that now, and we need to take that into account.
Right.
I've said it before, I'll say it again. One of the things that just breaks my heart is I see pictures all the time of friends who are out riding horses. I went to the rodeo a few weeks ago. Very, very few people are wearing helmets.
Right.
And that is definitely a way that we can prevent serious injury.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, the same thing's true of bicyclists.
Sure.
The only guys you see wearing helmets are the guys who think they're Lance Armstrong.
Right. And the same thing is true in Alaska. You know, a lot of people don't wear helmets to snow machine. They don't wear helmets to ride their four-wheelers.
Motorcycles.
Up until, gosh, what is his name? Brent Sass had a serious head injury running the Yukon Quest. You did not see very many mushers wearing helmets. You still don't see a lot of people who run dogs wearing helmets, but it's becoming a little more accepted.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, there are definitely a lot of risky sports that we do where people don't take precautions and wear helmets.
And don't worry about looking like an idiot.
Right. Who cares? You know,
go have fun and don't crack your skull.
So I'm seriously thinking, in addition to getting a helmet, I'm probably going to get one of those chest protection vests as well. It may be overkill, but you know, at this point I'm willing to do what I can to reduce my risk of injury, short of getting rid of the horse.
Right. Gonna look like Mad Max.
There you go. Hey, that could be kind of fun.
There you go.
I have to watch that new movie so I can get some extra dress points.
That's about all they got in the new movie, believe me.
The other thing that was recommended in terms of prevention and education was really talking about violence prevention. So, as you said earlier, in terms of children and the rates that are associated with assault, that rate should be zero. We also should be talking about elder abuse and intimate partner violence, and those rates should be zero as well. There's no reason to hit another person.
No shit.
Even though I have felt like throat punching a few people lately, there's no reason to hit another person.
Everybody feels like beating somebody at some point.
Right.
What differentiates us from the animals is that we can decide not to do that.
Right.
And we should be proud of that. And we should exercise that always.
You know, and I guess I just want to wrap it up by saying, until you have had someone in your life who's had a brain injury, or until you have experienced a brain injury, you have no idea how devastating and how life-changing even a small brain injury can be. It's horrible.
I'm going to trust you on that.
Yeah, don't go there. Just trust me.
Yeah.
So should we move on to fuck that guy?
Sure, fuck that guy.
Okay, so we both pretty much agreed that there's only one person who deserves to be the inaugural member of the Fuck That Guy Club.
I'm sure, but I gotta be honest, so much has happened in the last week that...
Well, I don't know about you, but I still think it's that CEO who bought that drug for...
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Right.
So,
yeah.
What is his name? His name is something like Shrekel? I'd have to look up his name.
Dirtbag.
Yeah. I mean, one of my friends was like, how do people look themselves in the mirror? How do they look in the mirror after doing something like this?
When you're a sociopath, you don't have to worry about it.
Right.
All
right.
So for everybody who doesn't really have a clue what we're talking about yet, last week, this gentleman, Shrekle.
I'm pretty sure that's his name.
His company purchased another drug company, or he purchased the right, actually he purchased the copyright on a drug that had been selling for $13 a pill.
And you know, I just want to interject, so it was billed as an AIDS drug. It's actually not an AIDS drug. It's a drug that prevents pneumocystis pneumonia, which that can happen to people with HIV. It can happen to anybody who's immune suppressed. It's actually not uncommon in pregnant women.
Right. And the point being is that this guy then took this pill that had historically been sold at $13.50 and raised it to, what was it, $750?
I think it was $750 a pill.
Yeah. Thus, trying to maximize his profits on the backs of people who are sick, potentially dying.
Right, because this is a serious pneumonia.
You know, and this is America, and you're allowed, in America, you are in fact allowed to do it, but we don't have to like it.
Well, and the interesting thing was, is that there was such a huge backlash against this guy that he actually backed down a little bit, and supposedly he's going to not spike the cost of the AIDS drug here I'm doing it too, of that pneumocystis drug that high. But we haven't really gotten anything from him about what he's actually going to do.
Right, and the truth is he's hoping that, you know, something else will come up that'll just get people looking the other way.
Right.
Because this guy, I don't know, sociopath.
Well, and remember, the American...
No empathy for human beings.
And the American consciousness is pretty limited. We can only hold a few things in the news cycle at any given time, so he's probably right. We'll probably forget about it, and he'll get away with it.
Well, because he knew the Pope was coming. That was going to take all the news cycle.
So this guy's name is Martin Shkreli. I'm going to spell it because I don't know if I'm saying it properly. Shkreli. And he is the founder and chief executive of Turing Pharmaceuticals. Turing.
He's also, I believe, being under indictment for some other business practices.
With apparently escalating cost of a pharmaceutical. I can't remember what pharmaceutical it was. And his defense is that this drug was underpriced and he's going to use the benefits, the earnings, to fund new research. Yeah, right.
Yeah, sure you are.
So, just a little aside story. So, there's a really common medicine that's used to treat gout, which is, I'm seeing more and more gout. I never thought I'd see this much gout, which is, that's an error of metabolism of uric acid. And it's caused primarily by overindulgence. So, people who drink a lot, people who eat a lot of organ meats or a lot of red meat can be afflicted by gout if they have this particular metabolic error.
In other words, Americans.
Right. And in the Middle Ages, it was definitely associated with people who were extremely wealthy, you know.
Right, but now everybody can get as much red meat
right.
as they want.
Now everyone can get gout. So there was this medicine probably 4 or 5 years ago. It's called colchicine. Very cheap at that point in time. Commonly used to treat gout exacerbations. And I called to send a prescription in for one of my patients and found out that it was no longer a generic drug, that only one company in the United States had decided to go through all of the hoops that the FDA wanted to go through to recertify this medication. So all of a sudden, overnight, this one company had sole license to this drug, a corner on the market, and they turned it into a brand drug and jacked the price up so high that a lot of my patients couldn't afford it. So it's not just jackasses like this guy from Turing Pharmaceuticals. It happens on a fairly regular basis.
Well, it may be because all estimates are that there's a high number of psychopaths actually as CEOs in this country.
I think that's probably true. I mean, I think about the CEOs that I've known and loved, haha, and I think that's probably true.
Yeah. No empathy? Yep.
Yep. So the CEO from Turing Pharmaceuticals gets the inaugural award for fuck that guy.
Fuck that guy. Coming soon, though. fuck that guy. We hate everyone.
So, all right. Just out of curiosity, you got your Oh, By the Way.
I have several.
Oh, go for it.
I have one, though, that will just surprise you as much as it surprised me.
All right, go for it. I'm excited.
So what's the greatest nuclear accident in the history of nuclear energy?
So I would say either Fukushima or Chernobyl, but I'm probably going to be wrong.
No, you would be right. Absolutely right. Behind those, then, what's the most well-known one?
I would say Three Mile Island.
Yep. Turns out in 1956, here in Los Angeles, one of our reactors went bad. Spewed shit in the atmosphere for years.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
I didn't either, right? I'm listening to a report tonight, and it's like, yeah, not only did it spit shit out in the air for, you know, a couple days, but no, apparently it went on for quite a while, like a few years. The area that's been contaminated is currently owned by Boeing Corp. And Boeing wants to turn it into parkland because the regulations for cleaning up, this is crazy, but the regulations for cleanup for housing or industry or anything are far greater than what it is if you just want to turn it into a park.
Okay, I know we have some listeners in California beyond just you. People, pay attention. This is huge.
I'm like, wow.
So
anyway, oh, by the way, yeah, we had a nuclear disaster here in LA back in the 50s that we never cleaned up.
Just out of curiosity, was there any stuff in this report about, oh, I don't know, cancer rates? Or
cancer rates in the neighborhood are 60% higher than average.
Wow. And has anyone looked at this land now to see how it is in terms of contamination and radioactivity?
Yes, there was a study done in 10 or 12, I forget. Anyway, basically, yeah, the place is still radioactive with stuff that has freaking half-life.
Wow.
You know, several hundred years. Boeing apparently has misrepresented this report, according to the report's author. This report, Boeing always misquotes it. Or takes it out of context to say that there's nothing really wrong with it.
Wow, this is an Aaron Brockovich moment.
Yeah, we'll see how it plays out. I mean, you know, now, of course, I'm paraphrasing one report that I heard tonight, and we'll see how it goes, but it's kind of amazing.
Wow.
Didn't even know we had a reactor up there, but...
I had no idea. I mean, I named all of the ones that I think most people would be aware of.
Yeah, apparently, no, this one's apparently quite... was covered up pretty good.
Wow. That's a pretty stunning Oh, By the Way. I have to give you the prize, man.
Yay, I win.
Did you have others? You said you had a lot on your mind tonight.
Oh, by the way, and this is one that we all know, but apparently it still needs to be reinforced. Oh, by the way, the Pope actually has a master's degree in chemistry.
Which
Jeb Bush, you fucking idiot.
Yes. And if we didn't have a good candidate for the inaugural episode of Fuck That Guy, maybe Jeb Bush would have won. But I can't believe he would make the same mistake that Rick Santorum made, was publicly vilified for several months ago.
No kidding. I saw that and I was just like, you really don't want to win, do you?
So for people who don't know, this week Jeb Bush basically said essentially the same thing that Rick Santorum said, which is that the Pope should not weigh in on global warming because the Pope is not a scientist. And, you know, I hate to say it, but yeah, actually the Pope is a scientist. So...
far more of a scientist than Jeb Bush, Rick Santorum, or any of the
right
climate deniers running for office.
Right. Currently. I mean, it's just, that's amazing to me. And it's just amazing to me that one of his handlers would allow him to make that kind of mistake in the run-up to the nomination.
Yep. So just to clarify, by the way, going back to this thing I was talking about, this was a near meltdown at the Santa Susana Field Lab in 1959. This is up in Simi Valley, which is north of Los Angeles.
Oh, which is like Shishi.
Yeah, you know.
Property.
The site is now owned by Boeing. gives a lot of, they point out that Boeing has given a lot of money to a lot of politicians.
To hush them up, I'm sure.
Well, to, you know, keep it from, who knows? Who knows why they give them a lot of, you know.
Yeah.
They would like you to draw the conclusion that the reason they gave them all that money was to hush all this up. But Boeing's given a lot of money. But, you know. Anyway, it was a pretty amazing story, so.
Wow. Yeah, I'm pretty amazed. And, you know, I would have never heard of that if you hadn't brought it up. Honestly, it would have just been one more thing that floated by in the news cycle that nobody really talked about.
Yep. Absolutely.
So you are now hearing our lab drinking water, I think, because she's about 3 feet away from me.
And apparently about 3 quarts low.
But I do have to say, and this is not a no, by the way, we're probably 3 weeks out from Podcast Central.
Excellent.
Yeah, so, you know, I may actually have a door that I can close and there will be minimal disruption, we think. So, anything else on your mind?
Oh, too much to even, it's all right.
Well, brothers and sisters, we are up in church tonight. I'm going to hold forth about Show Me Your Stethoscope. You've probably seen some of the stuff I've shared from that.
Oh, yeah.
So, for the people who have not paid attention to the hullabaloo that's currently taken over the nursing world, about 2-3 weeks ago, the women from The View, especially Joy Behar, essentially insulted the entire nursing profession and created this huge backlash. And as a result, there were about 16 people who got together and formed a Facebook page called Show Me Your Stethoscope. And it started out just with basically pictures of nurses showing themselves in their professional roles and trying to educate people about what nurses do. And it unfortunately has kind of devolved a little bit. I'm kind of getting tired of it. But I have to say, for about 24 to 48 hours, nurses broke the internet. It was pretty cool.
Yeah, it really was.
Yeah.
What a bunch of idiots.
So there are about 3 million professional nurses in the United States. And I have to say, in my lifetime, this is the first time that I have seen those nurses united around a common cause, which happens to be hating Joy Behar and Raven Simone. But hey, whatever it takes to get us all on the same page, right? So Show Me Your Stethoscope has kind of devolved. I see a lot of jokes. I actually, unfortunately, see some jokes that aren't very professional. But I saw something really stunning last night that really bothered me. So one of the nurses posted a comment like, what's the most ridiculous order or what's the most bizarre order you have ever received from a physician? And I thought back to something kind of funny. I remember getting an order to give one of my patients a cocktail every night with dinner. And I was kind of like, wow, I'm a bartender now. Okay. You know, that's really not something that you do very commonly in the hospital. But there were nurses who were writing things in the comments like, they had physicians say, do not call me about this patient again. They had physicians say in front of the patient who was still living, pronounce her and ship her. As in, I don't want to be bothered when she dies, so you better do it. I mean, horrible things. So I was really shocked and I really felt like it's time for us to have some radical honesty and to really engage the public. To really look at what, not just physicians, but what all primary care providers are doing and ordering and saying. So I wrote a rather lengthy blog about it last night and then managed to get kicked off the Show Me Your Stethoscope site because I was pimping my blog.
Oh, well. At least it was something worth pimping.
Well, you know, and the funny thing is, and you and I were talking about this before we started recording, is that I was kicked off of the site because it was not, quote, relevant. And I thought, okay, I'm writing about the site. I'm writing about things that we need to be aware of as consumers and as healthcare providers, and that's not relevant? No, your fucking joke about being tired after your shift is not relevant.
Right. Because we get it.
Right.
We get it, right? You know?
Right.
You guys work hard. Nobody's denying that. Nobody. And only an idiot like Joe Bear.
Or Joy Behar, yeah.
Yeah, Behar, whatever.
Yeah.
When you're that big an idiot, do I have to actually pronounce your name correctly?
No. I actually shouldn't have corrected you, but I just want people to know who she is.
It's The View.
It is The View.
Without Barbara Walters, right?
I think she's still got some sort of peripheral involvement, but I don't really know. The people who were really the offenders in this circumstance were Whoopi Goldberg, Raven Simone, and Joy Behar. So there's video if people really want to watch it. It's pretty sad. And there were several really bungled apologies. So
because the problem is people don't know how to apologize. They really don't know how to just stand up and say, you know, that was wrong.
Yeah.
I fucked up.
Yeah.
And I was trying to make a joke at somebody's expense, and I shouldn't have done that. And I do apologize for my bad behavior. And let it go with that.
Yeah,
and,
that would have been enough.
That would have been an apology, but, you know.
Yeah, I know.
You'd think with the whole crisis disaster subcategory of employment that has cropped up in the last 20 years, thanks to Gary Hart.
That there would be better, like, management of people than that, better handlers.
Yeah, better crisis management.
Yeah.
When the shit hits the fan. You know, when you're sitting there as the producer going, what the fuck was that? You know, you should be able to immediately hit the button, crisis mode. We're going to need to clean this up after we go to a break. We're going to need to go bitch slap somebody on TV and just get this fixed right now. And if we don't, then we're going to need to spend a lot of money tomorrow to fix it.
You would think, you know, it's interesting that you say that because they actually did lose several large advertisers as a result.
Exactly. And that's the thing that's important to note, right, is that this isn't just, you know, nurses were offended. It was bad enough that corporations went, yeah, we're done. Sorry,
yeah,
we don't want anything to do with you.
This is that nurses were unified and said, this is bullshit. You need to pull your advertising, and the companies listened. The thing that's important, and I guess I just want to get this out there before I lose sight of it, is that people need to hear nurses' voices. You know, the people who are really driving this movement and who really want to see something good come from it are talking about things like nurse-patient ratios and having mandated nurse-patient ratios, which means I only have to take care of a certain number of patients because that's what's safe, and you can't overload me. You have to call somebody in because we want all of our patients to be safe and well cared for.
Is there a downside there that I'm missing?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's that whole money thing from corporate healthcare.
Yeah, well, you know, the problem with corporate America, and always is the problem with corporate America, at a certain point, bean counters are in charge. And
absolutely.
You can only take so many olives out of the jar before you have no olives.
Absolutely. So, you know, and I mean, another thing that I would just really like to say, and this is my very, very strong belief, is that I can make a living wage, and healthcare does not have to be a for-profit endeavor.
Well, there's a whole lot of physicians over in England who would like you to know that you can live quite well in a non-profit.
And Canada.
In Canada.
Yeah. But damn it, I'm preaching that socialism thing again.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is always about the medicine is that physicians, you know, in these other countries, they get paid well. And the reason physicians, nurse practitioners, professionals, and let's get down to it. The reason professionals get paid well is because not everybody can do it. And it takes a significant investment of time and money to be in the game.
Absolutely. An investment of passion and spirit. It really does. I mean, right. If you really want to be a good healthcare provider, it's more than just the almighty dollar. It's more than just putting your brain into it. You're putting your heart into it.
Right. But, you know, and I personally believe that physicians should make a good living. I personally believe that nurse practitioners should make a good living.
And nurses. and CNAs and CMAs and anybody who's responsible for your healthcare.
Right.
You know?
But the country doesn't necessarily agree with us.
Right. Yes, what fresh socialist hell is this?
Right, I mean, you know, not that as a country we backed it, but, you know, I just got to remember that Wisconsin decided that, you know, the problem with their entire budget was that teachers make too much goddamn money. By the way, Scott Walker dropped out.
Yes. Fuck that guy.
Fuck that guy. And, he joins Rick Perry on the, I'm sorry. Who are you?
On the apology tour. Well, I do have a Neil Gaiman quote, and I thought it was really appropriate because we were talking about how fragile the brain is and how fragile that thing that we both agree is the seat of humanity is. So Neil Gaiman said in the writing Fragile Things, "There are many fragile things, after all. People break so easily, and so do dreams and hearts."
Ah, I love Neil.
Of course you do. So do I. So on that note, everybody have a good week. Hopefully we'll see you next week.
Yep. This is good.
All right. Take care. Tied up inside.